The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What were you doing while you were writing Fourth of July Creek?
Well, I'd worked on it for about 10 years. So I was going to grad school. I was writing letters for a chancellor at a university. I was doing just about any writing job I could. Before that, I was studying an MA program, getting a lit degree. And then as I was finishing it, I was working as a copywriter, freelance copywriter in advertising.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Smith Henderson about his debut novel, Fourth of July Creek. Before we jump into the contents of your novel, tell us about the 2010 Super Bowl ad you co-wrote. It was titled Halftime in America.
Well, I've had about the weirdest advertising career in the history of advertising. I remember when we were finished doing that, the editor slapped me on the back and said, "Well, you've peaked. You're not going to work on another ad as big as this one." So, which might very well be true. But I will say that if you want to have a piece of writing critiqued, a really good way, to do that is to happen to have it be a Super Bowl commercial. It was a pretty singular experience to watch on television. I got a text from my uncle, saying, "USOB, I'm crying." he meant it, warmly, but.
Did working in the advertising industry have any kind of effect on your storytelling all the while you're writing this novel?
I would say more my experience screenwriting, which ties into it. I mean, a lot of advertising is almost a condensed form of screenwriting. But the narrative necessities of a plot in a screenplay definitely became very useful in writing this book. There's a lot of strands, and getting them to all kind of culminate and come together by the end of the book was a challenge, but I feel like the screenwriting training helped quite a bit.
The shorter the piece is, the harder it is to tell the story.
Correct. Yeah, that's one of the advantages of a novel. It's as long as it needs to be. So you can do what you need to do, and as long as you need to do it, as long as you, take care of the reader.
Right. Fourth of July Creek is set in the fictional town of 10 Mile in northwestern Montana, and it's set in the 1980s. So pretend like most of the people listening have never been to Montana and never been to northwestern Montana, and tell us what that town is like.
It's a logging town. And also close to a mining town. It's been in the midst of a recession, like the country was in the late 70s, and it's one of the places where there is perhaps the beginnings of that strong desire to reset the country in some way. There's just a profound sense of disappointment in the direction of how things are going, and you can feel it in the economy. It's also filled with really independent-minded people who have a community that's sort of economically depressed, but they're pretty tight-knit. But it's a hard-drinking place, too. It's filled with a lot of dysfunction. So there's a lot of unhealthy family relationships. It's affecting the community as well,
And it's a small town.
Yeah, I think it's like 2,500 people. But the protagonist, Pete Snow, doesn't just serve the people in that town. He serves that whole region, from Kalispell up to the corner of the state. So he has a vast territory of potential cases, a lot of people living in not the best circumstances, but also fiercely independent and really suspicious of the kind of assistance he might bring and what he represents. And that was one thing I was interested in, is that tension between the good intentions of a social worker who's seen childhood trauma and knows how to help, juxtaposed against people who are fiercely independent and really don't want to admit that they need help. and are very suspicious of guys like him.
Mm-hmm. And he does have really good intentions and wants to help. But man, he is a mess. I mean, he can't even help himself, which is, I think, part of the really intriguing aspect of the book is that here he is out there trying to help and his own family is a mess.
Yeah, yeah. I worked for a couple of years in a group home, and that's where the genesis of his character came from. And I think it even started with the experience of getting off the first long weekend where I'd worked 36 hours kind of straight. You know, 3 days in a row, went home, you know, with a six pack, just was abuzz with the stuff that had happened that day and the things I dealt with, the emotional things I dealt with these young men who were living in the house. And you discover you've drank five beers and you're not drunk. And they started to see like, oh, this is a thing. Like, this is a thing that happens to people. If you don't take care of yourself, you start to somehow wind up getting into these bad cycles of behavior. And so I'm not saying that any of the social workers I encountered were like at all like Pete. The thing I discovered in my research was that secondary trauma was a huge issue. Anybody who's a first responder who deals with trauma, especially with children, on a regular basis, gets pretty messed up. And so I set the book in 1980 so that Pete wouldn't have the research and the resources behind him that social workers do now.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it would be more interesting to actually put him out on that island of the wilderness without any backup and watch that poor guy do his best.
And almost without even any oversight. He's out there kind of making up his job as he goes along.
Yeah, well, you know, in the world I created for this character, he is good at his job. And so the sense of his superiors is like, okay, great. You know, he's doing awesome. He's fine. He's out there. He's answering calls. We haven't gotten any complaints. You know, nothing terrible's happened. Okay, great. Thank God, you know. So no one's aware of the desperate straits he's in.
He gets called to a school to figure out what to do with this kid. And I'd like you to read that passage.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Some of the older children said they'd seen the boy on the playground. But no one talked to him as he edged his way along the fence to watch the kids on and around the jungle gym. He sat on one of the half dump truck tires in the wood chips, bonging his enormous boots against the rubber. The kids who noticed the boy didn't speak to him. Some 30 minutes later, Principal Pemberton found him on the second floor, outside Miss Kelly's art class. The nurse was with the child now. Pete and Pemberton regarded them from behind the glass. He turned to run. I grabbed his arm and he bit me. Pete looked at Pemberton. He showed Pete his hand. Didn't break the skin, though. Pete looked through the window at the kid. He wore brown camouflage pants that were rolled at the cuffs to fit him, and a darker brown sweater that hung on him wholly as netting. Leaves and pine needles stuck to the wool and his knit cap. His eyes scanned the room, lighting on Pete behind the glass, only long enough to look away and study the nurse, or the room itself. You know, I got him wrapped up, but just barely, Pemberton said. That kid is strong. He tapped on the glass and the nurse came out. He's got bloody gums, she said to Pemberton. I think he has scurvy. No one's seen him before, Pemberton told Pete. And he reeks, the nurse added. The boy stood with his hands on his hips. He ran a sleeve under his nose. His movements were swiftly mannish, as though he were another species and full grown for it, a pygmy or some other reduced people. Did you get a name off of him? No, he wouldn't tell me. So how's he been? Pete asked the nurse. You know, sweet as a bell. And no one has any idea where he's from. None of the other kids know him, nothing. Pemberton shook his head. The boy sat back on the exam table and unlaced his enormous boots, and after he pulled them from his feet, plucked out the rags balled into each to fill the space after his toes ended. He sniffed the second of these rags like it held some information, shook it out as he had the first one, and laid it to the side of him. He tugged off cheesecloth socks. His bare feet were sickening. A thin flap of sole skin hung from his foot, and he pulled it off like a piece of wet sack paper. He smelled this, too, held it up to the light, and tossed it onto the floor, where it set like a gray cold cut. The rest of his foot like a stem, a rotten tuber or root. "My word," the nurse said. The boy looked up at their blanched faces and resumed the crude debridement of his feet. Pete opened a notepad and wrote down the name of a pediatrician, tore off the paper, and handed it to Pemberton. The guy's retired and a little deaf, but let it ring and eventually he'll answer. Just ask if he can come down. Pete opened the door and went in. The boy glanced up, but he kept picking at his feet. Pete took a chair across from him. "Hey, I'm Pete." He leaned down and saw the gray sags under the child's eyes on an otherwise clean, pale face. There was a taupe grime of dirt and ash all over his clothes. He smelled like a burnt match and salted fat back. His chopped hair shot out in brown shocks. "So what's your name?"
"Benjamin."
"You mind if I ask how old you are?"
"Go on ahead,"
Pete grinned. "How old are you?"
11.
"Really? You don't look more than 8 or 9 to me." The boy licked his fingers and seemed to be pressing loose skin in place. "So where are you from?" The kid tossed his head. "In town somewhere?" The kid shook his head no. "Where's your mama and daddy?" The kid began to roll down his long socks. Light could be seen through them. "Your feet hurt?"
"Not bad."
"Well, you must have walked a long way for them to get like that." The boy pulled on the socks and then began to stuff the rags back into his boots. A vinegar odor wafted across to Pete. "Listen, I'm from DFS. I can take you home." The kid pulled on one of the great black boots and began to lace it. "Sorry, Department of Family Services, that's what the letters mean. I'd like to see if you and your family need anything. Help with the groceries or maybe some medicine or something." The kid tugged on the other boot and laced it too. "What do you think?" Pete asked. The boy stood on his newly booted feet and rocked in place on them. "I got a shit," he said.
Benjamin turns out to be the son of a formidable man named Jeremiah Pearl. Tell us about him.
Yeah. Pete's first interaction with Jeremiah is taking the boy out to see him. And the man's reaction is to make his son take off the clothes that Pete has bought for him. And Pete says, you know, "Hey, whoa, I'm just here to help. And I'm sorry if I offended you, but I definitely wouldn't have brought this kid back out here if I thought he was going to be running off into the woods naked with you." And Jeremiah Pearl says, you know, I'd kill him before I'd let you have him. And they take off into the woods. And at that point, Pete realizes, you know, that he's dealing with somebody who's pretty paranoid and pretty frightening.
He also has a gun.
And he has, he's got a rifle. He has a huge beard. He looks like he's like a mountain man. He doesn't look much better than his son does. But as the story goes on, Pete begins to discover that that Pearl is a known figure, that he's been leaving different totems around town of his anger at the government, and that he's been agitating for some sort of confrontation. And it becomes apparent to Pete that if he doesn't act, you know, this could end in the with Pearl and his family getting killed. So he tries to find them and try to help. And as the story progresses, he does begin to build a degree of trust with them.
I liked it, his technique of leaving food under a rock.
yeah. Just one of the pleasures of the book was going a little bit off script from the normal protocols of social work and letting Pete be that old hand at the job and let him do the things, you know, a little bit like that, the cop who's just going to do things his way. He's the social worker who's, you know, the burnout social worker who's going to get results, you know, by doing it his way. So there's that heroic trope to him.
He did sort of get results.
yeah.
You
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Smith Henderson, author of the novel 4th of July Creek. If you'd like to hear this program again or share it with a friend, you'll find audio online at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook page. And while you're there, please click like. We'll be right back to talk more about Pete Snow and his family and find out why Smith Henderson doesn't believe in evil. Don't go away. Pete is married, but he's estranged from his wife, and then his wife decides to relocate.
Yeah, his wife had early in the book has betrayed him, and he has reacted in a completely broken way by just departing, taking a job up in the northwestern part of the state, and living in a cabin. And you find out in a previous scene that his wife had made attempts to get his forgiveness, and he had ignored her. And as the story progresses, you find out exactly how broken they are. You know, at one point in the book, he says, "I take children away from people like us."
And they have a daughter who's 13.
13, and her name's Rachel, but she likes to be called Rose.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes you use a brainstorming technique in your writing that you've described as a way to have a conversation with yourself, which is how you told a lot of Pete's daughter's story in the book. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you would mind reading a short example.
Yeah, sure. What was it like on the way to Texas? It was Wyoming, which means to drive forever through ugly scrubscape the color of dirty pennies. It was just Wyoming along. They were Wyoming forever. You could Wyome all day and not make any progress. To Wyome was to go to nowhere, from nowhere, through nowhere, to see nothing, to do nothing but sit. You turn on the radio and Wyome through the dial, slowly, carefully, in search of a sliver of civilization, only to find a man talking about the price of stock animals and feed. Did her mom Wyome too? Mom Wyomed all through Colorado. She smoked, she drank coffee and tab and then beer, Wyoming her fingers on the wheel sometimes and stopping to Wyome to someone on the payphone, maybe daddy, but probably that friend in Texas, the truck driver. Is he your boyfriend? It's an old friend, Rachel Leslie. An old friend from when? From when I worked at the trucking company. He's a trucker. So that's why we're going all the way to Texas? He said we could stay with him, yes. What's his name again? Jimmy. And how do you know him? I told you, from when I was a receptionist. Did you do it with him too? What is that supposed to mean? Him to what? Oh, come on. I know why daddy left. Did her mother hit her or pull over or give her some kind of talking to? Worse. What did she do? She cried, drops big and quiet racing down her face. Did it unnerve Rachel? Rose. Did it unnerve Rose? Yes. Why? Because her mother's heart was Wyoming. It was Wyoming hard, and she was days and years and maybe forever from a good man.
And after her mother gets to Texas, and they've been there a few weeks, Rachel, Rose, runs away.
Yeah.
And then Pete is just frantic to try to find her. Explains some of what he has to go through.
Well, one thing I realized when I thought that, oh, you know, his daughter would, given what I'd written about her character, she would run away from home. And then I realized that, oh, well, Pete's strategy for finding her would be social services, that he would be able to contact people in different cities where she might possibly have gone and see if she'd been picked up and that she'd wind up in juvenile facilities. And so he gets these tantalizing clues throughout the book that his daughter is in one city or another, but she keeps slipping away from him throughout most of the book.
And I won't give it away, but I really liked how you wrapped all that up at the end. Let me just say that.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
Did creating so many characters, like Pete has a whole series of children that he's dealing with that he's trying to help. So there are several children in the book, plus there's Pete, plus there's Jeremiah and his family, mm-hmm. and then there's his estranged wife and all of her goings on, and then there's all these places that he goes to look for his daughter. How challenging was that to make all of those strands come out in the same place?
It took 10 years. It took time and a lot of concentration. You are writing by yourself, but you do ultimately need to rely on really good readers, people you can trust to give you feedback. And I was always fortunate to have some people I could lean on, and they could tell me honestly, you know, hey, this part isn't getting enough attention. And then when it was time to get ready to send out, I sent it to my agent. She gave me notes. My editor also had notes. So it's, you know, it's a long process. Even after you think you're done, you're not done.
Right.
So
but they helped you straighten out the kinks.
Yeah. I mean, at some point you've done as much work as you can do, and you're deep in the book, and you don't have a perspective anymore. You can maybe sit aside from it for a while and get it back. But it's sometimes faster just to ask somebody you trust.
Well, 4th of July Creek has been described with phrases like significant debut, masterpiece, a masterful achievement, a riveting story, and a mesmerizing accomplishment. And Ron Charles of the Washington Post wrote, 4th of July Creek is the best book I've read all year. Is it just kind of surreal to put one book, you know, your first book out there and get feedback like that?
I think you know the answer to that. Yeah, that's this is uncharted waters for me, for sure. I'm speechless, frankly. Yeah, it's great. It feels like a dream, but then you know that you put everything into the book. And so I'm incredibly gratified and grateful that it's being read in the way that I intended it to be read. That, you know, seeing that you met your intention artistically is a very satisfying feeling.
Anybody sending you a text saying, you've peaked now?
Yeah.
Forget it.
well, no, but the thought has crossed my mind, especially when people say, so what's the next book?
Right. Yeah.
But I guess that's my deal. I like to come out, I like to start out strong.
And you're working on a TV adaptation?
Yeah. You know, you were talking about all of the different characters and the plot threads throughout the book. I do feel, and also the other thing is that, given all of that material, and then given that Pete is fundamentally an investigator, I do think that there's something episodic about his job, and something that lends itself, obviously it's already a long form thing. It would be fun to watch. I'd love to play in that sandbox, I guess is the, mm-hmm. the main thing.
And especially with Jeremiah Pearl's character, so many places to go with that.
If I were an actor, I would love to play that part.
You said before that people have asked you what's next. 4th of July Creek ends in the middle of a sentence. Does that mean you have more to say? But you just had to stop because the book was already quite long?
Yeah. I felt very confident that ending as it does on a note of hope, but unresolved hope, that the reader is going to have to hope as well.
Hope for another book?
Yeah, or just hope that everything turns out for the characters that they're concerned about. That's, to me, in a lot of ways, like what we do often, what we are called upon to do often in life. We don't want things to be the way they are, but they are. and we're hoping for them, for the things that we've done to make a little bit of a difference. So that's why the book kind of ends like that.
Anything else you'd like to say about the book that I haven't asked you?
I will say one thing about, I would love to say about the book. There was, as I was working on it, a thought in the back of my head that it was very important that the book not be a caricature of some sort of fight between a flawed, godless bureaucrat and a deeply religious right-wing gun nut. That if the book was about those two caricatures, I would have failed. And what I was forced to do and wanted to do as a writer was view them with as much compassion as possible. And so to a certain extent, I feel like the book is ultimately calling upon the reader to see people make mistake after mistake after mistake and not judge them for their failures, but look at how many challenges they faced with dignity, shreds of dignity even, but dignity nonetheless.
And maybe see a little bit of that in themselves.
Yeah, I think we're pretty hard on each other and pretty hard on ourselves. And imagining people making mistakes, seeing people make mistakes, and then understanding them, to me, is a very virtuous thing, and one that I'm terrible at, and I'm guessing you're not the best at, and most of us aren't the best at. But I found that tension to be artistically interesting, mm-hmm. You know, that you sit down and have to reckon with these characters. All of them are deeply flawed. And still believe in them and hope for them and reach their best version of themselves. We all have our situations that we're in, you know? And I actually have a hard time believing in evil in people. It's just a thing maybe I'm naive, but I've just always had a difficulty believing that. And it's funny because like some of my favorite writers totally believe in evil. Flannery O'Connor has a 12th century Catholic kind of worldview that's absolutely black and white. Faulkner has a lot of humanity, but there are a lot of characters that are just outright terrible and awful. Cormac McCarthy, if ever there's a writer who embraces the notion of evil, he does. And I don't believe in that.
What makes you not believe in that?
Maybe lack of imagination. That may be just a shortcoming on my part.
Or maybe just that we walk around every day, we interact with people, hundreds and hundreds of people, and we don't come across those evil people.
Yeah. You know, there will be an example someone will throw up of a serial killer or or acts of pure evil or whatever. And I can't dispute that. But just as a belief, I don't believe in it.
Smith Henderson lives in Portland, Oregon. There's more about him and his novel, Fourth of July Creek, at mtpr.org/twq. You'll also find links to that information on our Facebook page. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.